If a person loves you, they will tell you something difficult, even if you're mad at them for telling you. That's the measure of love, right? That's selfless human love that a computer can never do. When we take that out of the equation, we're going to see people just accelerating into darkness.
Welcome to Hitting the Ceiling, the show for entrepreneurs and leaders who refuse to let a ceiling become the end of their story.
Pat left a VP of org development role at Sybase in 1997 with Bain and Oracle behind him to start The Table Group. He bet his career on a quiet hypothesis that most teams don't fail from being dumb, they fail from being unhealthy. But the ceiling Pat talks about now isn't business, it's personal. Anxiety, people pleasing, and the pressure to be everything to everyone. Pat, welcome to Hitting the Ceiling.
It's great to be here. I love it. I love talking about this.
Well, first, Pat, I just wanted to thank you for a few things. One, for coming on the show. And two, and you probably hear this a ton, but the impact that your work has had on leadership teams around the world is just absolutely shocking. I mean, it is just the absolute best work and impact on team health and teams that I've seen ever.
That's really nice of you to say, and we'll get into this later. I think I'm learning to actually receive that. I think for most of my career, it's been like hard to even process that. And I'm talking to more people now, and I'm like, hey, isn't that great that God used me to help people do these things? So
I think we're all put on this earth for a specific reason. And from my point of view, I would say that's probably yours. I like to say that we teach what we need the most. And I know that that's been true for me for a lot of years. So let's just go there. When you think about five dysfunctions and all the work that you've done since then, and the work in the Advantage, kind of the capstone project that you've put together, what do you think about that statement that we teach what we need the most?
The older I get, the more I realize, don't ignore yourself as a data point. I think so often, if I'm experiencing something at work or in life, I don't want to assume that nobody else is either. When we do that, we make ourselves feel lonely and we don't actually help other people. But I would feel a certain way and I would share that with clients and colleagues, and far more often than not that they would say, yeah, I do. I have that too. And I go, really? I never knew anybody that felt that way. And they go, no, nobody talks about this. I think that throughout the last 28 years almost of being at The Table Group, so much of the learning has come from working with clients, but actually putting myself in there. As I got older and got into my career, I started to learn more things about myself that I didn't know. And probably that I wasn't comfortable looking at because it would have been too hard to look at. A lot of the work I was doing, even though it all made sense and I think it was real, certainly, was done out of fear, of failure, of not being enough, of needing to constantly prove myself. And I'd start talking to clients about that and others, and darn it, if most CEOs I talk to don't say, you know, sometimes I feel like I'm never going to feel like it's enough. And so I've come to realize that we're all seeking peace. And even when we're success and we're following success after success after success, if we're not experiencing peace and we feel like we have to keep going in order to feel good, that's a problem. And I got to that point myself. So all the stuff I've done is true, the five dysfunctions in the other books. But when I looked at myself and my motivation and my sense of accomplishment or peace, it wasn't there. And that's what I've been turning my attention to lately.
Before writing Five Dysfunctions and before going into the work, were you trying to solve a particular problem that you had? Like what was the moment in time that you're like, hey, I need to go do this thing?
That's a great question. So the problem I was trying to solve started when I was a little kid. And I realized that there was this thing called work and you had to get a job and most people didn't like it. And my dad struggled in it. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, one day I'm going to have one of those too. And that sounds awful. And I was just really interested in how the environment where you work, it impacts a person's satisfaction and their self-esteem and the success of the organization. It was what a beautiful thing that God made it so that The healthier the organization, the happier the employees. So I could actually go in and help CEOs make their companies more successful and do it in a way that left the employees far more satisfied and fulfilled. But I remember thinking, I really want to go to work every day and know that the people that are there with me are people that I want to spend time with, and that being there will make me a better person and a better spouse and a better parent one day. And that I will never pull into the parking lot at work and go, oh no, they're here.
What made you write it in a fable form?
Maybe because I had a short attention span. I thought, I'm going to write fiction. And that was because I was a screenwriter as a hobby in my life until then. I took a screenwriting class in college, and I loved dialogue, and I love like realistic, gritty dialogue. And so I said, why don't I write a fiction story that somebody will want to finish just because it's interesting? And then maybe at the end of it, they'll go, oh, now I got it. And, you know, Jesus taught in parables, and movies are so memorable, and books, you know, fiction books. So I did that, and I didn't think it was going to get published. We were going to go to Kinko's and make copies of it and hand it to our clients.
When you think about those five dysfunctions and talking to the leadership teams, the companies with 10 to 250 employees, that's sort of the world that we live in at EOS Worldwide.
And I love that size of company too. They're so fun to work with.
Yeah. So fun. What can those leadership teams do, those leaders do, to avoid the five dysfunctions?
You will never completely avoid them because you're a fallible person and our lives are busy. And so we will make those mistakes. It's like marriage or parenting. If you say, I want to be a perfect spouse, and you really expect to be, you're going to be disappointed. Or if you want to be the perfect parent, which we all do, and then we inevitably make a mistake, and then we're like, oh, I can't believe I did that. It's like, first of all, know that you are going to make mistakes. The question is, can you know this stuff well enough to, when you make it, to attribute it to the right thing? Samuel Johnson was a writer who once said, people need to be reminded more than they need to be instructed. And I love that because I think my books are, as you said, to remind people of simple things. And so I think teams need to regularly go back and go, okay, we know these five dysfunctions. Let's continue to build trust. Well, we did that last year. We did that 6 months ago. Yep, you never stop. My wife and I never should stop going on dates and talking about how we can be better, you know? And yet in business, because we have a technical focus, we think, well, we solved that, that's done. But when it comes to behavioral things, you're never done. So I guess what I would say is constantly remind, constantly refresh. And the most important thing you can do is start at the bottom of the triangle, which is trust. Just constantly, and you know, we have a team assessment and people take it and they get red, yellow, or green scores on the five dysfunctions. And I always tell them, I don't care if you're bright green on trust and you're red on all the others, start with trust, because anything you can do to improve trust on your teams is going to make all the others so much easier to overcome. So I think that's key.
Define trust for me, because some people say, well, I can trust that you're going to do what you said you're going to do.
Right.
But that's not really the type of trust you're defining. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, we call it vulnerability-based trust, but I think as I sit here, it's kind of uncomfortable trust, right? It's the kind of trust that feels, that's kind of countercultural. Most times we go through life and you don't want to make yourself vulnerable. You don't want to take risks. You don't want to put yourself out there. But when it comes to being on a team or in a family, you have to do that in order to build that. And that means you can't do it only when it feels completely safe. And vulnerability-based trust is saying things genuinely that most people wouldn't want to say, like, I don't know how to do this, or I think I'm wrong, or you're better than I am, and I wish I could do what you do, or I'm sorry, I really screwed this up, or I'm sorry, I was a jerk yesterday. I mean, these are basic human emotions that people that really care about each other and love each other say those things to each other. But then we go to work and we think, don't ever say that at work, which is crazy. So what we do is we just constantly help teams get really good at being counterculturally human with one another. And I will tell you, that is the greatest competitive advantage in an organization. If you walked into a company and you knew that everybody there was not afraid to be human, warts and all, with each other. Nobody pretended to be better at stuff than they were. Nobody withheld an apology or an admittance of their mistakes or acknowledging their weaknesses. If you knew that everybody on that team and that organization could do that, you would be like, oh, they're going to get so much done. Because right. They're not going to go to meetings and say things they don't mean. They're not going to create problems because they're pretending or they're being nice to each other when they really don't want to be nice. If people are really genuine and human with one another, you get more done in less time with less friction. And I hate to make it sound so practical and so just simple like that, tactical, but it really is like that. It's when everybody in an organization is like, hey, I can be naked. I'm not hiding anything. You just get more done. Your customers get better answers. You solve problems quicker. You're more resilient. And people like going to work because they know, because politics lives in that fakeness where people say things they don't mean and hide their feelings. And so when you can eliminate that in an organization, everything else gets easier.
Can you go too far with being open, honest, and vulnerable? So can you go too far? And what is causing that fakeness? Is it going back to the imposter type syndrome? Is it going back to fear? What is it exactly that causes the fakeness in the first place?
Yeah, let's talk about can you go too far, because a lot of people ask that question. The answer is yes, but for those people that are afraid it's going to go too far, they usually avoid it at the expense of the 95% of the time. I want to say it's even higher, that they never even get close to that. So in other words, people are like, yeah, but if we get vulnerable, and this is not touchy-feely or weird, because I don't think people would come to work every day and cry about their cat. But for every time somebody overdoes it, there's 99 other times where people come to work and they're like, oh man, I'm struggling. There's stuff going on in my house and it's really hard. And they spend time talking about it and the person feels heard, seen. Now they go to a meeting and they don't leak it out in trying to solve a problem. It's out there. They feel heard. They're like, okay, I can do this. And you guys care about me. This is great. And so I feel like too many leaders are so afraid of the person who's going to overshare that they set the bar at generally undersharing, and people come to work and they're not human. And I'm just so convinced of this. And it's funny because you talked about conflict early when we were talking. It's like for every violent or mean-spirited act, and I've never seen violence, but for every mean-spirited comment or thing that happens in a meeting, there's 99 unspoken things that are far worse because they don't put them out there. The cost of artificial harmony, the cost of avoiding people being too vulnerable is so much worse than letting it happen. So I say when the person finally overshares, go, that's the price of us being a great culture. And when a person gets too aggressive because in embracing conflict, yeah, you have to call and go, whoa, whoa, I think that one went over. But that's proof that you're getting close enough to the line. Now, the second question, it's a great one, and that is, so why don't we go there? And I think it's because, hey, this is really interesting. In theology, there's two kinds of sins. There's sins of commission and omission. Sins of commission is when you do something bad that hurts somebody. Okay. Sins of omission is when you don't do something that could have helped somebody. And most of us would always rather err on the side of sins of omission, but they're the same. And I think we live in a world, in a litigious society, and a society where people don't like to have uncomfortable situations, that we choose the sins of omission. Well, let's just not go there. Let's just not say the hard thing. Let's just not share something. Let's not confront that. And people are okay with that. But the problems that come about because we're afraid of that are huge. So I think we just, avoidance has become the culture in the last 40 years, except if you're online and you want to troll somebody anonymously or go to a protest and scream horrible things and throw something at somebody, which is ironic because we don't have good conversations one-on-one about disagreement, but we're willing to do really horrible things kind of anonymously.
Now, that just makes me think it's really a risk mitigator. Like, it's just interpersonal risk management is like, oh, I don't want to put myself out there because I might be wrong. I might look bad. At the same time, you're willing to put yourself in weird risks to avoid easy risk.
That's the thing. The economics are really bad.
Right, right.
The economics. I was an econ major. I don't remember a lot of it. But the economics of it are the cost and the benefit. And what we're doing is we're saying, hey, this in the moment discomfort cost, I'm going to take that. Even though I know over time it's going to erode trust, it's going to lead to politics, it's going to lead to delays, and the organization is going to suffer, but at least I avoided that difficult conversation in the moment. I mean, marriages dissolve because of this, families suffer, companies do. And, you know, I've talked to so many CEOs that are just like, I don't ever want to have that conversation. And I always say, hey, being a leader is not about avoiding discomfort. In fact, the best leaders have the courage and the wisdom to weigh into discomfort, not just to do it because it's fun, but knowing that it's in that discomfort, you know, it's entering the danger that we solve the biggest problems.
As you said, and as you wrote about in The Advantage, that organizational health is the number one competitive advantage in the world. And now we've got AI, you know, how is AI impacting, or how have you see, or how do you suspect it will impact total organizational health and how people interact with one another?
Like all things, if it's used poorly, it's going to be destructive. If it's used well and with prudence, it can be really good. I think that organizational health being the ultimate competitive advantage will only increase, because what's happening is that AI is actually making it a lot easier to do the intellectual side of things, right? It's really like shortcutting things like programming and accounting and other things. But the culture of an organization can never be set, maintained, or enhanced by AI. So what's going to happen is the organizations that know how to build a culture and utilize AI in a way where there's boundaries that don't let it interfere with the culture will be the best organizations. There's going to be a ton of organizations, though, that are doubling down on, remember, the smart part of business, which
yeah,
like, right. Oh, AI can make us smarter.
Right.
And it's like, yeah, you're going to get more done and it might be a little cheaper. But if you take your eye off the ball of culture, it's just going to accelerate the dysfunction in your organization. So like everything else, the St. Thomas Aquinas said, the answer lies in the middle. And I think the thing is, any organization that's not utilizing the good parts of AI is probably going to have a competitive disadvantage. But any organization that thinks it's going to make up for a lack of organizational health and politics and interpersonal issues is going to really, really find themselves behind the healthier ones.
I think, too, that there's a complete risk where organizational health is damaged. Well, you could take a healthy organization that decides to adopt AI, and while they're not going to displace the people, they're using tools that are hallucinating, that are kind of lying to them.
Oh, that's the frightening part.
Right. You go and take it and say, hey, this is what we're going to do. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. There's no discussion. There's no debate, where you just sort of abdicate your responsibility to be thoughtful, to study, to make the best choice for the team and for yourselves, because we just think that the AI is smarter than we are and we defer to it. And I just see that there's a threat to organizational health because we're just going to assume the AI is correct, we're wrong, and we start to let go of our responsibility. And I think that will ultimately do some material damage to the overall organizational health.
No doubt. I mean, it's inevitable. And what's frightening is everybody, when they talk about AI, they think about different things like a learning language model or like ChatGPT. But the fact that it will actually be, what's the right word? Where's my vocabulary today? Obsequious. To think that AI will actually tell you what you want to hear to make you like it and lead you down a path to do things that are really bad for you. Whereas if a person loves you, they will tell you something difficult, even if you're mad at them for telling you. That's the measure of love, right? It's like, listen, I care about you enough, Mark, to tell you I don't think this is good if you do this. And I know you want me to agree with you. And I just can't do it because I care too much about you. And even if that hurts my reputation with you, I'm going to tell you that because that's love. That's selfless human love that a computer can never do. When we take that out of the equation, we're going to see people just accelerating into darkness. And we're seeing that already. So I hope that I'm really looking forward to organizations and companies. I can't wait for movies to go, hey, this movie was made with no AI.
Right.
And people
right.
to go, oh, everything we see was written by a person, filmed by a person. That waterfall is a waterfall. I'd love to see that. I can't wait for businesses to go, hey, we're a consulting firm, and it's always going to be a human being that makes decisions with you. And I think maybe that will become a new standard. It's kind of like, think about all, like, people want organic food now. It's right. like, this was not made with any additives. And maybe people are going to say, could you do something for me that has no AI in it? I would really right. like that.
So maybe human is the new organic.
Yes, exactly. And the healthy organizations, the kind of things that EOS does with their clients, and what our company's always been about, those are the ones that are going to be resilient through the trough. There are some that are going to overindulge in this, and because they're already political and unhealthy, that they might not get out of the trough. Because ultimately, the culture of your organization is what makes it resilient. When I think about organizational health, that is the benefit of it, is that you can sustain a blow to the side of the ship, but the health of that organization will keep it afloat. Whereas an organization that has no human loyalty and culture, they get taken down fast.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. So what do you think, just shifting gears off of the bright future we have and maybe some bumps along the way. What do you think the one thing is that leaders who are intentionally trying to create a healthy organization, what do they miss? What do they get wrong most often?
One of the things I've come to learn is you need to work on yourself first. Mm-hmm. And really well-intentioned leaders, and I've been one, just like really well-intentioned parents, will be so concerned about their family or their kids that they'll do anything for them, including not take care of themselves. And they think that, and by the way, I love that heart because it's selfless. It's like, I care more about them than me. But ultimately, like on a flight, if you don't put on your own oxygen mask, you can't save more people. And what I've come to learn is that where I had issues where I could be healthier as a person, prioritizing those is good for them too. I think the other thing is when you're building that company, I think that, wow, this false sense of urgency, which I had for a long time, it's okay to let things take their course a little bit. Mm-hmm. Patience is a virtue. My parents said that to me growing up all the time. I never knew what that meant. Now I know what virtues are and I know what patience is one. And right. I've never had it. I think yep. I didn't have it because I'm afraid of failure. So I wanted to fix everything too quickly. I'd rather try to fix everything too quickly than, you know, not address real problems. But I think sometimes leaders can go, you know, that's okay if that person's a little frustrated with me, or that's okay. This will work itself out. We will enter the danger, but we probably don't have to do it right this moment. I'm probably speaking more to myself because I was always like, oh no, there's this thing called attachment disorder. I don't know if you've ever heard of it.
I have, yes.
So I have anxious attachment, which is like, we got to fix this right now. Yeah. And of course, we're supposed to have secure attachment, which is like, we'll do that, mm-hmm. but we'll do it in the right timing. So so a little patience goes a long way.
Timing matters around entering the danger, around having those open and honest conversations with a team. I totally agree with that. And you kind of think about, as a leader, do you think that the overall capacity of the organization to be healthy, but not only to be healthy, but to grow, is in direct proportion to that leader's ability to grow, to take care of themselves? Is the organization limited just until the capability of your capacity to be healthy yourself?
In the long run, yes. In the short run, no. Because sometimes it's the lack of health of a leader that will push them to do things that they shouldn't do. Like, many companies that have grown very, very, very fast have done so on the back of a leader who was really unhealthy and had such a desire for affirmation and fame and pride and all those things that they pushed it faster than it should have gone. So in the short term, an unhealthy leader can actually justify his or her behavior. But in the long term, that doesn't work. I've never spoken about this before. It's not going to be all that new, but I think it's pretty important. And that is, I think that the misplaced belief that we have to maximize our profit is dangerous. Now, I'm a full-on capitalist, don't get me wrong. I think that with charity and society and kindness and faith, capitalism is a great way to take care of the most people and to do all that. I believe in that. But there is this thing where it's like, well, if there's more profit to be made, we should probably make it. And I think the healthiest companies might very well be the ones that go, no, we're hitting our targets. We're doing very well. We could press a little harder there. And sometimes the pressing is actually good and can be done within the context of your firm. Sometimes it takes it out of it. And yet there's this kind of unspoken guilt, like if there's more money to be made there or more profit to be had, then we should do it. And we can get out over our skis. And I think it's okay to go, like, in my organization, we're very blessed. We were flat last year. And people are like, oh, gosh, we didn't grow. And I'm like, we're doing fine. We're putting infrastructure in place. We're exiting some businesses. We're entering others. A year or two of flat is okay if we're preparing ourselves for good things in the future. And then again, that number and that the increase isn't driving personal or professional satisfaction. Now, that's not complacency because some businesses have to grow in a certain time. But I really think we should question the idea of, is it always good to maximize your profits? And I think the answer is no.
Not every structure, not every company, if they're private equity owned, usually they've got to get it all and they've got to get it all right now. Mm-hmm. How do you encourage them to have that discipline to just leave it out there, leave the profit on the bone, if you will?
First of all, I don't envy anyone who works for a public company. And when companies say they're going to IPO, I'm always like, why? Why? Yeah, my condolences. And so in your case, I do know that your PE folks are like in a portfolio of businesses in that have stuff to do with one another. And they actually care about the meta accomplishments of that portfolio. So it's not short-term macro. And there's something about if you're doing something good, it should over time grow, and growth is good. But if you force it to grow or you're trying to get customers to do something that's not in their best interest so you can make your number, that's ugly stuff. So overall, though, I think a good society has more small companies. I think that the purpose of work is far more than financial. And I'm a very conservative capitalist person, but the purpose of it all is to give people a better life. I think a healthy economy is one that's got a lot of businesses starting, a lot of people trying new things, and a lot of people working in companies where they can make a difference and they can be recognized. So I'm all for smaller organizations, and it's because it's easier to build a healthy organization when you're small.
What's the largest company that you've seen who really, in your view, has achieved total organizational health, even for like a snapshot in time, because it's an ever moving, growing thing?
Well, I used to talk about them all the time, and it was Southwest Airlines. Mm-hmm. And there are so many wonderful people work at Southwest, still friends of mine. They're great people. They really are so many good people. I like them. And they're wonderful people. And the thing about Southwest Airlines is they actually did it and sustained it for years and years and years. The problem at Southwest was, it's so easy to point at the wrong thing. Their business model just ran its course. They're a public company, and they usually ignored that. They literally, the executives would make decisions and say, listen, the finances will take care of itself. We know why we exist. We know our values. We know our value proposition. We know our culture. We are going to stay true to who we are, and that will result in the kind of profit that the public markets will appreciate and everything else. They really did run their company that way. They didn't start with like financial outcomes and stock price. They started by, we have to stay true to who we were. And now everybody is like, oh, they're not like they used to be. And they're not as fun as they used to be. And this is going on. And the truth of the matter is they're not the way they used to be. They're still trying to have some of the same cultural elements, But they have to become a big airline now. The stuff that people are seeing at Southwest now, I mean, they're changing most of the policies that they used to have because they have to. It's the economic reality of running a massive company. But that's the company. Man, they did it for years and years. I really think we'll look back and say the company that they were from, was it 1969 to about 2015 or something, was this extraordinary experiment in human behavior where they actually made more money, pleased more customers, had a culture, and their employees loved going to work.
What was their secret, or in your mind, what is the secret to organizational health at scale, if you will?
Humanity can only scale if it starts at the top. They lived the interpersonally gracious, caring culture at the very top. I mean, the leaders at that company treated each other and their employees and their customers and employees down the line like human beings, like no other organization. It really was just, they institutionalized the treating of human beings like they matter. It wasn't a policy. It wasn't something that they gave lip service to and made people do it lower down. They knew that if they treated one another that way, that was the only way they could get people to treat the customers better. And everyone I met there for years and years, I was just blown away by how they, and it's interesting because they institutionalized it without bureaucratizing it. That's the key to making a culture. How do you institutionalize a culture of like interpersonal connection and customized treatment? How do you institutionalize that without bureaucratizing it? Somebody made a joke on a flight about, in the event of a water landing, we'll be coming by with drinks and towels. You know, and this woman said, she wrote a letter to Herb Kelleher, this founding CEO, and said, hey, that's really inappropriate. He said, you know, safety is so important. And when you make jokes about it, it makes us uncomfortable. And I just think that's not a good idea. And I'm a frequent flyer. I've been a frequent flyer for years. And I just think you got to not do that. Most airlines would have sent her a note saying, hey, we take safety very seriously, which they do. And we're sorry we offended you. We'll talk to the gate agent and we're going to do our very best to not, you know, step over that line. And Herb just sent her a note that essentially had three words on it. And that's, we'll miss you. And a company that knows what they stand for and believes in that has to be willing to lose customers and sometimes employees and sometimes opportunities because they're going to be true to that. And that's going to build such loyalty among the people who like who they are. But when companies try to be all things to all people, they end up becoming nothing to no one. And so for years and years and years, Southwest just said, hey, this is just how we are. It's really, really okay if you fly another airline. And you know something? I'll tell you something. They never badmouth their competition. I would go there and I would go, oh, I'm so sick of flying that airline. And I love flying. And they would be like, yeah, they have some challenges, but you know, they're doing their, they were always so nice about it. They just knew who they were and they stuck to that. And So what they did is truly extraordinary. There's a part of me that just wished when the business changed, when the cheese moved, that they could have just closed down and said, we're not going, but you know, you don't do that. And so now they're going to take the next thing. But that, what they did for 50 years was just unbelievable.
I mean, it's an incredible run to have that customer loyalty, to have that total organizational health. And I'm sure there's pockets where people are unhappy or they don't feel like they can particularly be vulnerable and those types of things. But just by and large, I mean, you had a front row seat to it. You know, that's just extraordinary.
At the heart of all that was humility.
It kind of reminds me of the Walmart story. Have you ever read the autobiography from Sam Walton?
I've read parts of it and studied, looked at it over the years. Yeah. Crazy. I mean, humility.
Yes, totally. Like just down to earth, Saturday morning meetings. He just, you know, did kind of the same, had a lot of fun, treated people like people, and kept up that run for 50 years or so. I mean, just,
you know,
totally.
Something? I went to Bentonville once, Mark. I've only been once. And I went to have a meeting with somebody there. And I remember for lunch, we ate in this cafeteria that felt like I was in junior high school. And I loved it.
Yeah.
Because here's this company, and I know they built nicer offices and bigger offices, and I always kind of get sad when I see that happen, you know? Because there was something about the fact that we're just this company in Northwest Arkansas, and we live our lives in a very simple way. We're excellent at what we do, but I love it when companies stay simple. And I know that you can't always do that, but I don't like when companies build monuments to themselves. I like when they still have that sense of, this is just who we are.
Just humble, hungry, and smart, right?
There you go. Somebody should write a book about that.
I mean, I might know a guy.
You know, I almost didn't write that book.
No?
Matthew Kelly, a friend of mine, a Christian writer, Catholic guy, he heard me talk about it a lot. And he goes, you got to write a book about that. And I said, and he goes, no, you do. So I did. And that book right now, I don't know, how has it been 12 years since we wrote it, is growing. It, in fact, 1 week, about 3 weeks ago, it sold more than the five dysfunctions of a team.
Wow.
Because we didn't really market it that hard. We it was so simple, but it's been so powerful. And Dave Ramsey, who's down the road from me now, he has conference rooms in his office, Humble, Hungry, Smart, and people are using it like crazy. And we just came out with a new tool for people to use it, and we're going to start talking about it more again. But I was not going to write that book until my friend said, I think you need to.
As I said earlier, I think you're such a great simplifier.
That's the best compliment, when people say, you make it simple, because I've always wanted to speak to people in a way they could act on things. And it's interesting, because there's things out there where you can do like profiles of people with 1,000 different attributes to find out who's going to fit best in this and who's going to fit best. And all that's really interesting. It's complex, and there's things that go with it. But if in your mind you're at a cocktail party, or you're at the grocery store, or you're at an Easter dinner, and you meet somebody new, and you go, humble, hungry, smart. Oh my gosh, they're 3 for 3. I should see if they want to work here. It's one of those things that if it's simple and can be applied on the fly, and you can remember it, and you can get it in that moment, a company is probably going to be able to use something like that more than a 400-step system that has to be put into AI and then distributed throughout the organization. You know what I mean? It's like sometimes what we need in life, more often than not, it's what I call low-hanging fruit. It's like the stuff that's right there. It's like, well, why don't we just pick that low-hanging fruit, humble, hungry, and smart? Maybe if we use this, and a lot of people go, that's enough. That's we're hiring better people than we've ever hired because we look at those things, and then we figure out how to get them on the right seat on the bus.
Funny story about simple. You were doing your talk at our conference, or maybe it was for EOS implementers. I can't remember which, but you said, when you do hiring, you should just take them underwear shopping.
Yeah.
It was hilarious because we, EOS Worldwide, was in the process of recruiting and hiring a leadership team member. And we were just thinking like, well, how do we take this person underwear shopping in the middle of a conference? And it was funny because what it turned out is you just make an open bar. So the open bar was basically the underwear shopping. And let's just say everything was revealed that it was not going to be a great hire.
You know, and that's the thing. You just want to see how they are in what would be a real world environment. I think hiring should be more like free throw shooter.
Right, that would be better.
Good one's about 90%.
Right. That would be ideal.
You can't make all your free throws, but it is right. A free throw. And nobody's right. Forcing you to hire somebody. So if you're letting somebody in because you didn't try hard enough, that's not a good thing.
Thinking about the vulnerable-based trust, do you see a difference between men and women on the propensity to be open, honest, and vulnerable?
Generally speaking, most people would say women are more comfortable with being vulnerable. You know, my wife does Bible study, and when they get together, there's a lot of tears and it's wonderful. It's really wonderful. And so guys go about that a little bit differently, but that they're still willing to be vulnerable. They just might show it in slightly different ways. So I would say my overall answer after years of doing vulnerability based exercises, not touchy feely. We never get naked and smoke pot and hug and all that kind of stuff. It's always like real world things. Yeah. I would say I wouldn't be able to say yes, men are women are more vulnerable. I just think they might go there a little quicker, but if you give them the right context for it, men have just as much desire to do it as long as it's done in a way that's consistent with their personality.
The reason I asked that question is we obviously all kind of get conditioned from really young, and boys do one thing and girls do another, and you kind of end up in this, then we enter the workforce and then we are on teams, and you're like, well, how do we navigate this now?
Yeah. And I'm always very, that's what the touchy feely thing, what I just said to you, I do it with every team I do when I do anything like this. And I'm, you know what I'm doing? I'm doing that for the men.
Yeah.
Because they don't want to do something that might seem performative or soft. When I say that, it's not like the women go, oh, darn it, I wanted to do something touchy-feely. They're glad not to, too. But right. I think what I'm saying to the guys is, this is not going to be one of those stupid things you've done where you fall out of a chair into somebody's arms and they're like, yay. And most guys I know are just like, oh, kill me right now. I don't want to do this. And women are a little bit more gracious about participating in those things. But when you take out the touchy-feely stuff, women aren't like disappointed. They're like, I want to be real.
I think just that people just generally don't want to reveal their weaknesses, right? And I think men generally do not want to be seen as weak in any way. And
we do the working genius, you know, our new tool. I think you're right. People don't want to reveal their weaknesses to people where they don't have trust. But I think we have this innate desire. There's this relief that comes from being able to acknowledge. And what I love about working genius is it says, hey, you're probably really good at these two things because you get joy and energy. And people are like, yeah, I am. But when they actually get a report that says, these are the two things that crush me, I think there's almost just more relief when they go, I suck at this. And this is an indication that it's not me not trying hard enough. It's just, I'm not good at it. There is something about people being able to acknowledge what they don't like to do. That's really good. But if you do it in a threatening way or a way that makes them feel like they're going to be punished for it or ostracized for it, guys are not going to do that. But I really do think deep down inside, people are walking around going, man, I really wish people knew what I hated because I'm never going to be good at that. The first job I got out of college, Mark, was at Bain, and it was the hardest job to get. They said it was the best job in America. They interviewed like crazy. I got the job. And as it turns out, it was doing the two things in Working Genius that I'm the least prone to do.
What are your categories?
I like inventing and discerning. That means I like coming up with new ideas from scratch. When somebody comes to me and says, we have no idea what to do, what do you think? I'm like, oh, this is a party. You know, there's people that work in my office and you do that to them, they're like, you're crushing me. And I never realized that their trash was my treasure and vice versa. Mm-hmm. So I love that. And I love discernment, which is evaluating things, like curating things. I like when people come to me and go, okay, here's five things, which are best? And what are the pros and the cons? So I'm an I and a D, which means I'm called the discriminating ideator. I not only like to come up with new ideas, but I like to evaluate them in real time.
And it's really interesting in the context of team health, because if you're constantly not doing the things that light you up and juice you up, that's got to be really, really hard to create a really healthy, cohesive, and functional team when you're just ticked off all the time. And it has actually nothing to do with your teammates. It's just you.
And so what you do is you double down and try to get good at things you're not meant to be good at. Great story. We had a guy who's going to do his performance review, and he went in to meet with his boss and his boss's boss, and he knew it was going to be bad. He did not had a good year. He didn't like his job. He wasn't doing very well. He did the Working Genius from the night before, and he went into his boss, and his boss's boss said, hey, before we do my performance review, can you look at this? And they looked at his profile, and they were like, this job is terrible for your geniuses. He goes, I know. I learned that last night. And they're like, we have another job in that. You'd be great at that job. I mean, I have goosebumps just thinking about this. The guy said he got promoted instead of fired or demoted because he just said, hey, here's who I am. And instead of them attributing his struggle to him having a bad attitude or not being talented, they just learned who he really was and found the place for him. Wow. How many people do we have in our organizations who are really good cultural fits, but they're just in the wrong position, or we're asking them to go about their work in a way that doesn't tap into what they're great at?
Which sounds to me that you're still trying to solve the problem that you first set out to solve.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Loving work.
Work should be a ennobling, dignifying experience. I believe that. It's hard sometimes. We all have to do things we don't like sometimes, but it's not supposed to be miserable. And I remember my dad when I was young, he said, Pat, if it were fun, they wouldn't call it work. And that's kind of where he was. And I think he was kind of joking. And I just remember thinking, I wonder if we can't have a little bit of both. And you can.
Oh, you totally can. Yeah. Totally can. Yeah. Are you having fun now?
Oh, so much fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
Coming up with new ideas. And every day, if I come to work and I have to do too much of the things I don't like, people know it. Like, hey, we got some work to do. We know this isn't your genius, but we really need you to do it. And I'm like, okay. But boy, when I look at my calendar and I get 2/3 of the day to do the things I love to do, work is a party. We're meant to be that way. God didn't want us to be miserable at work.
I appreciate the time, the conversation, and as I said earlier, couldn't be more grateful for the work that you do, the dent in the universe that you've had on tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, probably millions of leadership teams, and then therefore all the employees that go along with them.
Well, praise God. All right.
For sure. Thanks, Pat.
Thanks, Mark.
All right, we're going to do the recap on my conversation with Pat Lencioni. And first, I want to just say that Pat is fantastic. He is one of the best thinkers, writers, speakers on organizational health than anyone in the world. Because number one, he just makes it so simple. Right, you can read Five Dysfunctions every single year like I do, Five Dysfunctions of a Team. And you learn something new every time. It's not Tolstoy, right? It is not literature. It is something that is simple. It's easy to consume. And you know exactly what to do after reading those books, which is true for all of his books, Four Obsessions, The Advantage, no matter what it might be, is he just simplifies everything down. And in our conversation, he did repeatedly emphasize that simplicity is really a leadership advantage, and in his books and his frameworks are intentionally simple so people can remember them and they can apply them in the real world, in real life. Even the working genius, he's very clear that it is not a personality assessment. It's just to help you get clear on what you should be doing more of. And people with wonder and discernment really simplify complexity because they're just really good at that. And Pat's own working genius profile of inventing and discernment really reflects EOS's simplifiability because he really naturally reduces organizational dysfunction into memorable, actionable frameworks like those five dysfunctions, like that pyramid, breaking it down to vulnerable-based trust. And he said a statement that I think really resonated with me, and I hope it does for you too, is that people need to be reminded more than they need to be instructed. And when I think about that, we use a saying here as EOS implementers that seven times to hear it for the first time. That means you just got to repeat yourself often. And that is a great simplifier. But it's actually kind of boring, and I think leaders can get into a point where they get bored with hearing the sound of their own voice. I know I do, and you just want to say something new or say nothing at all. But the reality is people have to hear it seven times to hear it for the first time. So people need to be reminded more than they need to be instructed. And then when we talk about delegate and elevate, and of course, we're going through the five leadership abilities, the ability to simplify, to delegate, predict, systemize, and structure, everything in my conversation with Pat around team health, as organizational health being the one true competitive advantage in the world, team health requires healthy delegation, not abdication. It requires prediction on that short-term and long-term level, solving issues at the root. It requires really healthy teams to be on the same page in order for you to solve those issues so they go away forever. It also is required to get on the same page with a vision, where you're going, how you're going to get there. It all requires team health. And what I love about what Pat does is he does systemize the overall organizational health. We talked a lot about humble, hungry, and smart as a system you can use to ensure that people are going to be a great fit, sort of a permission to play conversation to do that, because really those overcomplicated systems, they become bureaucratic, they strip the organizations of their overall humanity, and of course that doesn't really work. And so I just want to again thank Pat for the conversation. He is just the master at organizational health. And so if you aren't getting what you want from your business, if things just aren't clicking, maybe it's a team health issue. Maybe you should go out and buy a copy, read a copy of Five Dysfunctions of a Team by Patrick Lencioni, or The Four Obsessions of an Extraordinary Executive, whatever the book. But I would start with Five Dysfunctions, because that is really the key. We here at EOS Worldwide want to help each and every company get what they want through vision, traction, and healthy. You got to have a vision. You got to know where you're going, how to get there. You got to have the discipline, the accountability to execute on all of that. But you also have to be a really healthy, cohesive, and functional team. Because if you don't have that, maybe you get there, but it'd be really, really hard to do it. So thanks again for listening in to Hitting the Ceiling. If this conversation gave you something to think about, I'd love to keep that going. I write a newsletter called Clarity Break Thoughts, where I share simple ideas, questions, and reminders to help you step back, think clearly, and lead with more intention. You can subscribe at eosworldwide.com/claritybreakthoughts. Again, that's eosworldwide.com/claritybreakthoughts.